This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. Neil Dutta has been doing economic analysis and research from a market-based perspective for over 20 years. He has a fascinating career and has been a whole lot more right than wrong than most of his fellow economists who cover the street. I found this to be just an absolutely fascinating discussion about how to best contextualize the world of economic data around you in a way that's useful for you as an investor. Very often, there's a ton of information that comes out, and by the time it's released, it is fairly meaningless to what the market's going to be doing a few months hence. Understanding nuance, understanding that the world isn't binary, is the challenge for investors, and few do it better than Neil does in terms of putting together a global view of what's happening in the economy, what's happening around the world, what's happening with the Fed, and what's happening with the stock market. I found this conversation to be fascinating, and I think you will also. With no further ado, RENMAX, Neil Dutta. So let's start out with a little bit about your background. You graduate cum laude from NYU with a BA in economics and poli-sci. What was your first job in the economics and finance space?
So I was actually thinking about being a lawyer. So I ended up taking my LSAT my senior year at NYU. And I did okay, but I didn't do well enough to go to a school that I really wanted to go to. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, I was kind of scrambling. And I was like, I need to get into the financial industry because I'm in New York. I have a passion for finance. But it was kind of late. So a lot of the investment banking analysts had already lined up their gigs. So I ended up getting a job at Merrill Lynch as a compensation analyst in human resources.
Really?
Yes. So
that's
that was interesting. So I did that. I started that in 2005 after I graduated. But one of the good things about being in HR, Barry, is you kind of know where all the jobs in the organization are. So fast forward about a year, and a job had opened up as an economic research analyst in someone you may know, David Rosenberg.
Of course.
So that was actually my first foray into economics, and the rest is history.
You also worked as an analyst at Barron's. Tell us a little bit about that. Where was that in your career path?
Well, that was really more of an internship than anything else, but I worked with Gene Epstein.
Oh, sure.
The economics editor at Barron's, a noted libertarian enthusiast mm-hmm. now, but yeah, I mean, that was back when, I guess, Alan Abelson was running the Up and Down Wall Street column.
Yep,
now,
yep.
Obviously, it's Randy, but...
Right, Randall Forsyth,
who's
another Gene Dolan, right? Donlan, Alan Abelson was must read each week, Randy Forsyth. They had a killer lineup.
And Gene basically wrote a weekly economics column. So that was my sort of first foray into just analysis in terms of economic data, right? Like some of the tools that people would use back then, right? Haver Analytics was a big one.
Right.
And so Gene kind of introduced me to that.
So when I was a trader back in the 90s, my Saturdays always began with a big mug of coffee and Barron's. And, you know, back before you had everything at your fingertips, it took a little bit of effort to find things in the pre-Google days. And sitting down with Barron's was a weekly routine. And it felt like it was the publication that everybody on the street was poring over every week.
You think it's still that way?
I think the world has changed radically. Clearly, Twitter is the new tape. I see things on Twitter before I see them on the terminal because I could be in the car on a train or something and something will cross Twitter. And I'm sure it's on Bloomberg at the exact same time because they parse Twitter constantly. but I don't always have my terminal up and open in my face, certainly not when I'm driving.
No, I agree. I think that the whole FinTwit community is probably the most useful uses of Twitter as a sort of social media tool.
To say nothing about how easy it is to find anything online, not just through Twitter, but Google also is an enormous resource.
Sure.
So the 90s were what, 30 years ago, right? Very different world, two and a half decades have passed. You're not on Twitter, as far as I can tell.
I am on Twitter. Well, we run our company account.
But not under your name.
No, not under my name. We sort of run that as a company policy.
Uh-huh.
I tweet. I try to put information out there. What we try to do, of course, is to make sure we're sending it out a little bit later than our clients get it, because then, you know, why pay for research in the first place if you can get it for free on Twitter? But yeah, I mean, you know, we started that account maybe in 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've been growing it ever since, and
Jeff's stuff. I
we have
the
a good
Graf
following.
Stuff all
yeah,
the time.
Yeah. What we try to do is promote our in-house ideas.
So let's talk a little bit about what you did at Merrill Lynch. You worked with Rosie, which I'm sure you have lots of stories from that. What was your role there? What sort of research and writing did you do?
Well, so when I started as an analyst under Rosie, I was basically a junior economist. I mean, one of the great things about Rosie, I mean, you know, was just, he is, I think, one of the best examples of what a Wall Street economist should be. Like, mm-hmm. we had this weekly piece called The Market Economist, right? And that, I think, is very important because he was a markets economist. He wasn't a PhD, and he didn't think like one either. Mm-hmm. And what I think he understood and what he kind of ingrained in me, very early on, is that this is really fundamentally, if you're a sell-side research economist, you are in the client service business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Rosie was really great at. He was always on the road. I mean, gosh, I don't even remember. I don't even remember when I saw him.
Right.
because he was always on the road, particularly in 07 and 08 with Rosie, it was kind of wrong, and then spectacularly right, mm-hmm. right? And so when he became spectacularly right, you know, he was on the road constantly. And so one of the things I would do for him was just kind of feed him ideas, feed him charts that kind of reinforced his thesis that he could then go and present to clients while he was on the road. So a lot of it was sort of getting in the weeds on charts and data. But that's what I would do for him. And then, you know, as I got better at that, he kind of gave me a little bit more freedom in terms of allowing me to write. And obviously, if you work in a bulge bracket like that, you're obviously writing under the lead analyst, right? Mm-hmm. So my name would go on the reports, but they would be under his, of course. And he gave me a little bit more freedom as time went on, and I would end up writing his morning note, which was the widely read, you know, Rosie right. tidbits, remember? I mean, those...
Breakfast with Dave.
Now it's Breakfast with Dave. Back then, it used to be called Rosie's Morning Tidbits.
Uh-huh.
And I think that was a play on... Because, you know, Rosie was Canadian. It's Canadian.
Still is.
Still is. And in my career, I feel like the Canadian, they produce a large number of economists.
Yeah, that's kind of
interesting. It's kind of right. I mean,
comedians and economists. Why is that?
I have no idea, but I think the Tidbits was a play on Timbits, right? Tim Hortons. It's sort of their version of Dunkin' Donuts, I guess. And so he gave me some freedom in writing that for him.
So Rosie actually ends up going back home to Toronto,
yeah.
I don't know, 09. And so now you're at Merrill without him writing Hurt on You. What was it like when you had a little more latitude to go where you wanted?
Well, it was actually an interesting time because when Rosie left, things were starting to turn around a little. And I remember I wrote a piece basically, I think in June 2009, basically saying that the recession was over.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, it was a controversial call. But that was when we didn't even have a head of economics.
Right.
Because there was a bit of a sort of murky, you know, let's say 6 to 9 month period where Rosie had left and it had been a, you know, and then Ethan Harris had yet to come in.
Right.
So we kind of had a lot of freedom in terms of what we wanted to do. And, you know, so I wrote that piece. It got a lot of attention, I think. But yeah, I mean, it was a good call. And I think
yeah,
it was interesting
to say the least.
Because here you had Rosie, who was a noted market bear at the time.
Right. He never would have put his name on that piece.
Right. And, And so in some respects, I was able to, and I, you know, I mean, we used a lot of the same framework that he used, looking at a lot of the same indicators in terms of, you know, Rosie would talk a lot about leading indicators, the ECRI index, mm-hmm. and a lot of them had been turning around. So we had basically said, look, like, things are getting better, and it sort of reinforced, the upturn in markets. So,
and speaking of markets, how often is down 57% not a pretty decent entry point for equities?
Oh, sure. Well, I mean, one of my buddies, Sam Rowe, who you probably know.
Oh, sure. TKer is his Substack.
And he has.
I didn't know you guys know each other. Sam's work is great also.
Yeah, I mean, I think very highly of him also. And one of the best things that he says is stock markets usually go up. That is a 100% factual statement.
Yeah, not always, but most of the time.
Most of the time.
Right.
And
it's tough being on the low probability side of the street.
Right. And I think that sort of set a lot of the kind of trajectory over the next several years, like after I left Merrill and when I started at RenMac. And just if you couldn't figure out by 2010 or 2011 that the sky is not always falling, you'll never figure it out. I mean, because we had so many things happen. We had financial crisis, double dip recession fears, right? There was that debt default thing, and mm-hmm. then China hard landing. That was like this perennial thing, and European sovereign debt crisis, and stocks kept going up. And so I feel like, you know, over my career, right? I mean, I started working under Rosie, mm-hmm. right? But I feel like over time, I've actually been pigeonholed more as like the more market optimist, economic mm-hmm. optimist. Not
so. Let me channel my inner Rosie and push back on you a little bit. Markets always go up. Tell that to someone who bought Japan in 1989 or bought China in 1994. You're down 20% in China. I think you're still down 40% in Japan. It's decades later. What do you mean markets always go up?
Well, U.S. equity markets usually go up. And we're very much U.S. Focused here.
Mm-hmm. I don't disagree with you, by the way, but those are the objections that always come up. They're, but, if anything, they're the exceptions that prove the rule.
Well, Japan is an interesting example because, of course, after the financial crisis, that was a very prominent example of what the U.S. could turn into. We're going the way of Japan. But I think in many respects, because that example existed, that's why we, in fact, didn't end up that way. We sort of cleared out our banking system. We recapitalized our banks very rapidly compared to Japan. Obviously, Bernanke is a student of what happened then.
It's as if we learn from other people's mistakes.
Exactly. And think about, I mean, what was notable about that sort of post-financial crisis recovery was just how steady it was, sort of month in, month out, continued declines in the unemployment rate. And, you know, if you go back to some of the literature around, you know, the Swedish banking crisis, sort of the Nordic banking crisis, it was sort of, you know, 6-7 years, you clear out the excess and things start to pick up. And that's pretty much what happened, right? I mean, by 2013, the household deleveraging was basically over mm-hmm. and the economy was gaining a lot of momentum.
So how did you end up at RenMac? You were at Merrill. Tell us how you found your way there.
So so as I mentioned, Rosie had left. I think it was really in March of 2009. It was a classic
bottom, exactly.
Yeah. Contrarian. He left at his peak. And I think in September of that year, Bank of America Merrill Lynch at that point hired Ethan Harris, who I think he was at Lehman Barclays. Mm-hmm. And so I worked with him for until 2012. And, you know, Lehman was a huge sort of fixed income shop. And that's where Ethan's focus really was. And obviously, you know, Merrill was more of an equity shop.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that Ethan gave me a lot of latitude to do was just kind of service the equity sales force at Merrill Lynch, because a lot of his focus was really, I think, more on the fixed income side, more on the Fed. So I had a lot of sort of opportunity because it was kind of this runway that I just had. And what I would do is try my best to kind of, you know, remember what the equity sales force loved about Rosie and try to apply that in my own way. So one of the things that I think that Rosie did really well is just kind of take the economics calls and make them useful for an equity market investor, right? So if you think inventories are done clearing out, what does that mean? Well, it should be good for manufacturing. Now, let me call. I mean, and you have all these analysts that are covering all these companies. So why don't you go pick up the phone and talk to them and see what they say? And then for an equity sales force, that is a great thing, because when you have your macro guy talking to your analyst, you can pitch that to your clients. Like, okay, my macro economist is telling me that inventories have bottomed out, and here's what, I don't know, John Inch, who was, I think, the industrials analyst at the time, here's what he's saying about Caterpillar and Deere and so on and so forth. And whenever you have that, it makes a very good morning call, and it makes a very good marketing tool. So I would try to do that a lot. And as I did more of that, I would be asked by the sales force on the equity side at Merrill to kind of, can you come on the road with me? Can you come out to California and talk to so-and-so? Can you Texas and so forth? And so I would do a lot of marketing for equity accounts at Merrill. And I was really only like a VP at the time. I was a pretty junior level person. And so that got me going. And then I got approached by RenMac in 2012. And now I've been doing it for them for this last decade.
It's funny you mention what the institutional sales guys like. I have a buddy who was institutional sales at Merrill for a long time. He is not public, so I can't drop his name. But my favorite thing that he said about taking Rosie on these road trips, they called him a wind-up toy. Doesn't matter who the institutional client is. You would give him like an 8-second tee-up. Oh, this is an endowment. They focus on this. They're interested in this aspect. They turn the key and wind him up, push him in, and Rosie would just be a fire hose of nonstop data, context, information. Uncle, whatever you want. Yeah, you get the order. Leave me alone.
No, yeah. I mean, for me, it was a great education, I think, those first 7 or 8 years at Merrill, because I had Rosie. I was fortunate enough to work with two greats, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Ethan Harris is one of the best. I mean, he had a great call this year, in the last year. I mean, he was the first one to basically say, you know what, the Fed's going to go every meeting. And at the time he said it,
was pretty radical.
Yeah.
You had a pretty good call also. The end of last year, in fact, I recall, I think it was on surveillance, Bloomberg Surveillance, you came on and said, oh, the Fed's going to raise at least 4 times. That was a very out of consensus call list. We'll talk a little bit about that a little later, but you were very much pushing against the consensus that it's all good.
Well, so, I mean, I think, again, one of the best things that Ethan Harris actually ever told me was, in this business, it's about picking, like weighing probabilities, mm-hmm. and then picking your battles with the consensus wisely. Like, I'm not the kind of person that's just going to be contrarian for the sake of being so. Like, that to me doesn't really make
sense. Listen, the market is the crowd.
Exactly.
They're right most of the time.
Right. And so you have to just pick your battles wisely. And I think in that case, I mean, 4 was conservative. I mean, in hindsight, that was, I mean, at the time it sounded sort of radical, but in hindsight, it was obviously not enough. But so I think that to me set the sort of stage for me at RenMac. And I think it was very helpful to sort of come up under those two guys.
Huh, really interesting.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
So we were talking earlier about your December 21 call. You thought the Fed would raise at least 4 times. Let's look at what happened in 21. 4 75 basis increases, 2 50-point increases, 1 25-basis-point increase. Why was everybody so sanguine? Why did we all miss the fact that the Fed was suddenly going to, slam on the brakes?
Well, I think you just have to go back to the initial reopening of the economy, right? Mm-hmm. And in hindsight, we basically had a V-shaped recovery.
Couple of $1 trillion of fiscal stimulus will help.
We threw a lot of money at the problem on top of that, right? I mean, we turned the lights off, we turned it back on. You had a V-shaped recovery plus all the stimulus, plus, paycheck protection. I mean, when we had that first employment number that sort of knocked the lights out, everyone was kind of surprised because we were all keying off the initial claims data, right? And so we had seen that, maybe these companies were hiring people back pretty quickly.
I remember at the time the Atlanta Fed GDP nowcast was something like minus 52%
right.
GDP, which obviously is a horrific extrapolation. Sure. But that's why I think a lot of people were surprised at how robust.
And at the time, remember, Barry, I mean, there was a legit debate going on. Are we going to have an L-shaped recovery?
Right.
Are we going to have a U-shaped recovery? And I think a lot of the issues around the Fed trajectory was just a function of that. And we basically had a V-shaped recovery, and that warranted a very aggressive response from the Fed.
Although we'll talk a little later about how belated that response was. They clearly could have started tightening earlier at a slower pace, but let's put a pin in that. I want to talk about your call where you said there's going to be at least four increases. Tell us a little bit about your process. What are you looking at that leads you to say, hey, the consensus is way too sanguine. They're missing this. The Fed is really going to step up here.
So I think the first thing to do in this business is you want to make sure you have the nowcast right, right? Mm-hmm. Forget the forecast. Let's just figure out what's going on right now and what's been happening. And at the time, what did we know? Inflation was coming in a little bit firmer.
A lot firmer. Back
and unemployment was falling more rapidly than people thought. So what do you expect the Fed to do at that point? And oh, by the way, they're behind, right? Yeah. So
They always?
I mean, you could make that argument. But, you know, in this case, they were kind of very much keying off of labor market dynamics for their reaction function. And the unemployment rate was falling very, very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And so that's what started it. And
that's the area you're looking at that, hey, this is a red flag. Everybody is way too sanguine about CPI.
I think the thing that really got it for me was what was going on in the housing market, right? I mean, if you have this sort of pandemic event and people go out and what's the thing that pops first is residential investment and home sales, that to me is a huge issue, a totally opposite from the last crisis.
Right.
Because, and what do we know about housing? It's like an irreversible decision, right? I mean, once you buy a home, you can't just go out and be like, oh, don't want to do that again. I mean, you can't return it. So you have to be very, very sure about the macro environment before you make a down payment on a home. So the fact that people were willing to do that, I think kind of led me to believe, okay, if housing is historically a good leading indicator for the economy, and that's what's really surging right now, what does that mean for everything else? And obviously, if you're going to buy a home, you have to fill it with stuff. And we had a huge boom in stuff.
Right.
And that, to me, is what did it. So, you know, to me, the V-shaped recovery and the good side of the economy, I think, was an important development. And
so let me ask you, we'll drill down a little bit into the specifics. There are all these sort of binary debates around inflation. Is it goods or is it services? Is it fiscal stimulus or is it monetary? Is this demand-driven or is this supply constraint-driven? What are the factors? How do you take those pairs of contradictory positions and reconcile them? What do you think about those choices? And it obviously can be a little bit of everything. It's not just one thing.
Well, in this business, is always nuance. Nuance never gets enough attention, but that's usually where the answer is. I mean, on inflation, is it supply-driven? Of course it is. Is it demand-driven? Yes, it is. I mean, it's both.
Well, if supply could answer demand, we wouldn't have inflation.
Exactly.
So it's got to be a little bit of both.
It's got to be a little bit of both. I guess in terms of where we stand right now, you know, clearly there's a lot of improvement on the supply chain side. We're seeing delivery times come down.
Shipping containers are back to pre-pandemic
right.
levels.
You know, obviously we know that motor vehicle assemblies are picking up some steam here. But demand is still very, very strong. I mean, if you look at something like real consumer spending of goods relative to its pre-pandemic trend, I mean, there's been no big sort of collapse to trend. I mean, it's sort of working itself out through time, right? I mean,
We had that big spike
and
we haven't come back down from it. We've just plateaued with a slight up until the December 2022 consumer spending. It looked like the upward bias was going on forever.
Yeah, and that probably overstates things, right? I mean, we know that looking forward, auto sales will probably be running better than 13.5 million SAAR over the next several months. we already see
next several months, next several years.
Because
there's no used cars to be had because there were so little few new cars.
100%. And then on top of this, look at home building stocks over the last
on fire.
Yeah. What does that tell you? I mean, a lot of these growth pessimists that we're talking about, oh, housing is the leading indicator. Well, where are they now? I mean, housing is starting to revive. And what do you think that means for durables?
Well, keep in mind, you mentioned how things lagged post-financial crisis. We underbuilt single-family homes for, what, almost a decade? And now suddenly there's been massive household formation pre and during the pandemic. What are we short, 1 million houses, 2 million houses? It's a giant number.
Yeah. Yeah, if you assume like a normalized vacancy rate, it's probably a little over 1 million units, right?
So that's a lot.
And you're also in a very strong demographic patch for housing, right? I mean, people are, you know, we're sort of in our prime marriage years as a country. And so that helps as well. I mean, one of the interesting developments out of the pandemic is just we have a bit of a mini baby boom going on, right? And so what does that mean? So people are not only going to buy a home for that Zoom room, now they're buying a home for that nursery. And I think people figure it out. I mean, one of the things I think people will be surprised to see is just look at what the incremental drop in rates will do for housing activity, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so people got locked out when rates went from 6 to 7. Now they're coming back down to 6.
Right, we're at 4 month lows, about 6.3%
when we're
recording
this. Right, and
you're seeing
things like mortgage demand pick up and
even in the sixes.
Right, exactly. Right. Huh.
I mean, that's double what it was a year ago.
And the thing is that it never got as low as it did in 2014, despite 7% mortgage rates, right? So what does that tell you about underlying demand? So I think to me, that's an interesting kind of development here. And obviously, if you have a pickup in housing, that's going to provide, you know, some tailwind to things like household durable goods, furniture, carpets, appliances, stuff like that.
Huh. So we're in a sort of weird zone where Jerome Powell and the Fed is telling us, hey, we're not done raising rates. And when we are done, we're keeping them up here for a while. Markets seem to disagree with that. How do you think about this, you know, tug of war between what the markets believe about rates and what the Fed is saying about rates?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, as you know, there's this sort of thing that goes around Wall Street where the equity guys are the dumb guys and the bond guys are the smart guys, right? I don't believe that.
There certainly are elements of truth to that because the bond guys tend not to blow up the way some equity guys have. Maybe that's a bad example, but I think that's what colors people's perspectives.
Well, I mean, there was the great Samuelson quote that we all know of, right? Like the stock market's, you know, predicted 9 of the last 5
right.
recessions, right? But in reality, the stock market has probably predicted 4 of the last 5 Fed pivots.
Right.
Right? So, I mean, how bad can the stock market be? How dumb can that money be if that's what's driving a lot of the Fed's reaction function at times?
And if you think the bond market is smarter than the stock market, well, what's the inverted yield curve telling you that the Fed's going to end up doing?
Well, it means that they're going to push the economy into recession. I mean, I guess the one thing I would say about the bond market is that the bond market has a habit of pricing in tightening cycles way before they actually start, right? So there's always these sort of opportunities in the front end of the yield curve early on in an economic cycle. And they tend to price in the end of the tightening cycle after it starts, too soon. Mm-hmm. Once the cycle starts, the bond market tends to price in the end too soon. And I think this is probably another one of those times because I don't think the Fed is going to cut. And one of the reasons why is because there's just too much economic momentum behind the U.S. economy.
So you were talking the other day on TV about landings, a hard landing, a soft landing. What happens if there's no landing? Tell us what you mean about that in terms of what are the stock and bond markets pricing in and what are your views on the economy for the rest of 2023?
Well, I definitely think the odds of a no landing scenario are going up.
What is a no landing scenario?
Let's
no
say,
recession.
Yeah, growth at potential, if not little better. I mean, I guess for me, it's, you know, what's the mechanism for the recession, right? I mean, the argument now is what? China's reopening and Europe is looking a little better and the U.S. economy is going into recession. I mean, in my experience, the causality never goes that way. It goes from the U.S. to the rest of the world, not the rest of the world.
The argument is the Fed over-tightens, they kill real estate, they kill consumer spending, and that tips us into a mild recession.
So it's like, it's the Milton Friedman, like, long and variable lag argument.
Yeah.
You know, Milton Friedman, I mean, that
which may or may not be all that accurate.
don't think it is.
Fed has been talking about, if you look at some of the Federal Reserve research papers, they're saying, hey, maybe Fed activities work with a shorter lag than we've been led to believe.
I mean, yeah. I mean, back in the 80s, I mean, research analysts would figure out what the Fed did 3 weeks ago, right? Based on what was going on in the money markets. Now it's, they tell you what they're going to do and the markets price it in instantaneously.
Right.
But I think the growth impulse from financial markets is already flipping positive. So how could it, I mean, the funny thing about this long and variable lag argument, if it's an 18-month lag, what was happening 18 months ago? The economy was ripping and the Fed was reiterating its lower for longer approach. So that means monetary policy was really, really easing. So are we still dealing with the easing of 18 months ago? It's ridiculous. Right. So no, I mean,
even if you go back a year, you had inflation ticking. What was it, March 2021? CPI went through the 2% target rate. So
real rates were cratering, right? I mean, so the lags are not long and variable. They're short and predictable. And you're seeing that already, right? I mean, as an example, we just talked about how interest rates have been moderating. What have we also seen? We've seen mortgage purchase applications pick up. We've seen home building stocks do better. We've seen builder sentiment pick up. It's instantaneous. So and it's the same thing. I think you can make that argument with the dollar, right? I mean, everyone's kind of up in arms about, oh, the ISM manufacturing PMI is below 50. Yeah, and the dollar's off 10% from where it was in September. What do you think that does for factories? Obviously, it juices exports.
Doesn't hurt them, right? You were talking last year about, in 2022, about King Dollar and how strong it was. How do you contextualize a move in the, like a 20-year move in the dollar like that? What does that mean in terms of inflation and economic growth?
Well, more recently, obviously, the dollar decline is, I think, an unambiguous positive for U.S. growth because it's going to juice exports, particularly of manufactured goods. But a lot of the rally in the dollar, say, from 2014 to, you know, up until recently, I mean, a lot of that was just growth differentials, right? I mean, think about why the dollar moves. The dollar moves really for, I think you could say, two reasons. It's basically growth differentials and policy differentials.
So wait a second. I have to interrupt you because all I heard during the 2010s was QE and ZIRP were going to kill the dollar. Financial pressure, the dollar is done. Light a bonfire, they're no good. They're worthless. And I recall having that thrown at me over and over again. It couldn't possibly have been more wrong.
No, I mean, you know that doom sells on Wall Street. There is a steady diet of...
This is my fourth doom cycle, I think.
Yeah, I mean, but to me, it's actually kind of... It's kind of shocking, like, how enamored people get with these doom and gloom sort of ideas, because they don't pay at all. I mean, it's one of these things where one of the things I've learned is that the negative case always sounds a little bit more intellectual. People give it a little bit more attention. But one of the things that I've learned is that in this business, people that get one call right tend to be wrong about most everything else.
Yeah.
And I think this is, you know, I mean, so as an example, like the gold bugs. And I mean, it's the same sort of thing, you know? And I think that you can make that argument with the dollar. The dollar, I mean, there's no alternative, right, to the U.S. dollar. It's still the reserve currency because we have the most liquid, the deepest capital markets in the world, right?
So, right. And nobody trusts China. Nobody trusts Japan, Europe. Where else are you going to go?
And until that changes, you can't really make that argument. And so for me, it's, why does the dollar move? The dollar basically moves because of policy and growth differentials. And so in the 2010s, the reason the dollar was doing so well is because U.S. economic growth was a lot better than Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It was a lot better than Asia. I mean, we were talking about a China hard landing like literally every year following 2012, right? So China reflated, and basically every year after that, it was hard landing risk in China. So I think that's why the dollar moved. And right now what's going on is the dollar is, I think, losing steam because people are getting a little bit more optimistic about what's going on globally.
So in other words, after a really strong pandemic recovery here in the U.S., the rest of the world is finally beginning to catch up with us. And that's before we talk about the end of zero COVID policy in China and them
exactly.
Reopening. So you sound like an economic optimist looking out the next couple of years.
Well, I'm certainly an economic optimist relative to the consensus. And I think the consensus is way offsides, as I think the Fed is way offsides right now on growth.
Meaning what?
So they're cautious.
So the consensus is too cautious. Do you think the Fed is in the process of over-tightening here?
No, I mean, I'm of the view that they probably – I think the Fed will probably step back soon. I mean, they're basically telling you that they get rates up to something a little over 5% and stop. The question in my mind is whether they're stopping too soon.
Really?
I do think – I think that you can make that argument because – I just feel like financial conditions are easing too much. They didn't really – they shot their shot, mm-hmm. and at the same time, fiscal policy tightened last year in 2022. Right. And despite all that, the unemployment rate finished the year at .. 3.5%.
So let's talk about that. Yeah. We referenced earlier that there was a shortage of single-family homes in the United
sure.
States. Let's talk about labor. Immigration has been on a downward trend long before Trump. My
sure.
friends who blame Trump – it started ticking down way before him. He might have spoke a lot about it. I don't see the Biden administration moving off of the Trump policies limiting legal immigration. You have a lot of early retirements. You have a lot of disability. We lost, I don't know, 250, 500,000 workers due to COVID, to say nothing about the people affected. And I've seen estimates from 5 million to 15 million people who were affected by long COVID. We have a massive shortfall of workers. How are you going to get unemployment to tick up or wages to slow under those circumstances, short of causing that hard landing we've been talking about?
Well, I mean, you can have some of that addressed through policy, mm-hmm. right?
But are we? Is anyone addressing that?
No. I mean, that I don't. I mean, you can maybe see. I mean, I think part of the issue, though, is think about who's filling some of that vacuum. Right. I mean, you are seeing participation rates rising for those age 16 to 24 years old, not prime age workers, but younger people.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of them are coming in. Now, what does that mean? You're basically you talked about retirements. You have a lot of inexperienced workers coming in. What does that mean? Those aren't the most productive people. So experienced people are leaving. Inexperienced workers are coming in. That's not necessarily the best dynamic for labor productivity, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's going to take some time for those workers to kind of get up to snuff, right? But that is inflationary from the Fed's perspective. Remember, the sort of equation that Powell always references is compensation growth equals inflation plus productivity. That is sort of a identity that they use in macro. And if
What's wrong with that?
It's not about what's wrong with it or not. I mean, I'm a business economist. I don't have an opinion. For me, it's what are they telling me? You uh-huh. know what I mean? For whatever reason, the Fed views the labor markets as the conduit. And if compensation growth is running, right now, let's say it's 5%, mm-hmm. and productivity is 1.5, you're basically talking about an inflation environment of 3.5%-ish.
Which is not terrible.
From their mind, it is. Remember, the one time you had a soft landing in the U.S. economy, right? So this is one of the things. I do think we have an increasing odds of a soft landing right now, but that doesn't mean the odds are increasing permanently, right?
Mm-hmm.
Think about when we had a soft landing. The example that most people will remember is the 90s. So what happened during that time? First of all, we didn't have a formalized inflation target of 2%. And number two, what was the call that Greenspan nailed? He got the productivity call right. At the time, I mean, Janet Yellen was telling him, you got to keep hiking. Like, look at how low the unemployment rate was getting. But what Greenspan came around and said was, well, look, productivity's taking off. We probably don't need to be hiking as aggressively.
So let's talk about that productivity number now, because I have my entire career been perplexed by these very, what's the old joke from, was it Professor Solow at MIT? Productivity numbers are showing up everywhere.
But in the statistics.
Right. And as someone who's a white-collar worker who can operate remote, I feel like every year my productivity is up 15, 20%. Now, if you're working in a factory or if you're delivering mail or something else where technology isn't helping you that much, you're probably not seeing those sort of technology gains. Am I just seeing the world through my narrow perspective, or is the data missing a lot of productivity gains?
I don't know that the data is really missing that much. I mean, productivity has been weak even in the areas where it's very easy to measure it, like manufacturing. So right. That to me is something that's important to point out. But you know, think about capital spend. I mean, right? So capital deepening is what drives productivity, and that's basically CapEx relative to labor hours, and that hasn't been particularly strong either. So what's the? I mean, I get that there are interesting things going on.
Yeah.
But I don't know that that's necessarily going to drive significant gains in productivity. And of course, as I mentioned, labor quality is a lot worse now than it had been before. So I think it's a bit more, for me, it's a little bit more challenging to accept the idea that productivity is going to save you from the inflation.
So let's talk about that inflation. You know, for at least for the median wage earner and below, prior to the pandemic, their wages lagged everything. It lagged inflation, it lagged the stock market, it lagged corporate profits, it lagged C-suite compensation.
Sure.
So it seems like suddenly the bottom half of the economic strata is seeing wage increases, and the Fed is like, hey, slow down a little bit. What's that about?
It's a nasty little secret. I mean, look.
Not such a secret.
Well, I mean,
there was a giant New York Times piece a couple of Sundays ago in the magazine section talking about who is the Fed increases falling the hardest on.
They view the labor markets as the conduit to achieve their inflation goals.
Mm-hmm.
We can debate whether that's right or wrong. I mean, I'm not an academic economist, but that's what they're telling us. And so if that's the case, then unemployment is one way they're going to achieve the goal of getting inflation back to 2% in a sustainable way.
Seems like a 20th century central bank confronted with a 21st century problem.
I mean, it may well be, but I think, look, I mean, right now, the labor markets are still very, very tight.
Right, and very robust.
And there's still an inflationary impulse from the labor markets. And, you know, look, I mean, I think that this is also, in some respects, maybe a tell on our society. I mean, what do you think most people would prefer, right? I mean, would you prefer 5% unemployment and 2% inflation, or 3% unemployment and 4% inflation?
It depends if you're the guy that's unemployed or not.
I mean,
if I'm unemployed, I don't really care what the hell inflation is. I got no income.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of the reasons why I think Reagan became president and Sanders never will, right? I mean,
I think you're right.
Because I think it's much easier, I think, to form a political coalition around inflation than around unemployment, because it's always, now I got to pay for that. You know what I mean? Like, that's how, right? Because
yeah.
The baseline expectation, like your social contract in America, I think, is, you got a job. Like, to me, it's like, yeah, I got a job. Great. Good for you. Everyone has one, you know, whereas, the prices for these things are going up like 6%. That's weird. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's why I think politically it's much easier for politicians to address that than unemployment.
Prior to the
I mean, even in 2008, right, Barry? I mean, yeah. think about this, right? I mean,
well, the 2000s, there was a giant spike in inflation, arguably caused by the Fed taking rates too low and keeping them there too long.
I mean, core inflation during the 2000s was running a little bit. I mean, I think around 2.5%. But in 2008,
but it spiked up, you know, right into the crisis.
In 2008, the bottom was falling out from the economy. And we were having, you know, we had like 5 or 6 months of job losses, even as gas prices were going up.
$150 a barrel oil. Yeah.
Were people talking about, let's go and like, you know, stopgap the banks and like, even though, no, they weren't, right? Because, you know, it was like, what had more public support? Suspending the gas tax or bailing out the banking industry at that time?
Absolutely. No, there was very little support for bailing out the banks. And in fact, there was the whole Tea Party came about.
Right.
When you attempted to bail out the homeowners, there was a lot of political cross currents during that period.
So I think that to me is sort of this interesting kind of dynamic, is that it's a lot easier politically, I think, to fight inflation.
Really interesting.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
So we've been talking a little bit about what the consensus is and what the Fed's going to do. All these rapid increases in rates we've seen, you've said you question whether or not the Fed has a coherent strategy. Explain that.
Well, I mean, they're kind of playing catch up, right? I mean, I think based on their behavior over the last 12 months, it's pretty clear that they should have started sooner. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been so aggressive in the first
place. Let's put some flesh on that. The CPI goes through 2% in March 2021. By the end of the year, CPI is what, 7%, something like that? And in March 2022, the Fed first starts raising rates. They're like a year behind the curve.
Well, I mean, they very much were anchored to, I mean, there's a recency bias in policymaking. You know, in the same way that fiscal policymakers were criticized for not doing enough during the financial crisis,
sure.
You could make the argument that fiscal policymakers overreacted during the pandemic crisis.
So what do we have? We had $2 trillion in the first CARES Act. We had another $1 trillion in the second CARES Act. Then the new administration comes in. There's another $1 trillion in the third CARES Act. Then there's the Inflation Reduction Act. Then there's the infrastructure bill. That's a lot of fiscal stimulus, isn't it?
Yeah, and remember back when Trump ran and they had the whole TCJA. What was the big
2017?
Yeah, what was the big discussion then? Monetary offset. Remember that? Monetary
right.
offset. Like the Fed needs to come in and counteract the fiscal stimulus. Well, think about it this time. There's a lot of fiscal stimulus that needs to be counteracted, particularly when people are still sitting on $1 trillion of pandemic savings.
So how much of that can be accomplished with quantitative tightening, unwinding quantitative easing, and how much of that has to be purely rate-driven?
I think it's rate-driven because I don't know that quantitative tightening has that much of an effect on...
Really? Because people were warning, oh, you don't understand what a headwind. QE has been a tailwind. Not only is that gone, now you have the headwind of QT. Just you wait. That was the last doomsayer.
I think QE was basically a way for the Fed to tell the markets that it really meant business about keeping rates low for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, let's say the Fed came out and stopped QT because they want to maintain like a ample level of reserves. Does that tell you anything about what interest rates are going to do? No. The Fed can raise rates whenever they want. So that to me is, I don't think it's really the same thing. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, there's always these sort of, there's this like knee-jerk kind of desire, I think, in markets to like explain things like as simplistically as possible. And so it's like, oh, like here's this overlay chart of the Fed's QE and the stock market, and that's why the stock market's
right.
going up. And it's just...
Are you suggesting
it's
that
absolutely,
it's not that binary, that it's more nuanced, to use your earlier phrase?
I mean, to me, it's just a ridiculous thing, because if you take that to its logical conclusion, the Fed has an infinite ability to expand its balance sheet.
Sure.
So that means that the stock market should never, ever go down, if that's what you'd write. I mean, so if you think about it logically, take it to its end conclusion. Does the central bank have, is there any constraint on the Fed in terms of printing money, doing QE? There is none, really. I mean, so it's political, but... You know, theoretically, there's none. And so if the balance sheet is all that drives the stock market, then the stock market should never go down. You have to think about it that way. And so to me, the stock market's driven by earnings and by
fundamentals. Right.
And
sentiment.
And sentiment. And, you know, the Fed can play a role in sort of backstopping sentiment in the short run, but the Fed can't permanently increase the level of asset values.
Huh. So there's been a lot of discussions about when Powell is going to pivot. Are you saying we're overemphasizing that? Is the market sussing that out early enough? How much should investors be paying attention to each and every utterance from Jay Powell and his band of merry central bankers?
Well, I think it's important to follow the data. And ultimately, if the Fed is saying that it's data dependent, then the data will drive their views on policy. You know, I must admit right now it does feel that the Fed is kind of moving a little bit away from that, because it seems like they just want to get rates just above 5% and kind
regardless.
Of and wait and see, regardless of whatever happens.
So let me throw some data at you. It looks like inflation peaked mid-year last year, certainly on the good side. We talked about energy, lumber, shipping containers, used cars, even Rolexes are rolling over in price. So that's 60% or 40%, depending on what year you're looking at. That's 40% of the inflation problem. What about services? We continue to see at least owner's equivalent rent portion of CPI appear elevated. What are we to make of that? Is the Fed looking at the data, or are they looking in the wrong place?
Well, I mean, Powell kind of spliced the inflation data into three parts, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he talked about core goods inflation, which is, I think, what you're getting at, which is it's deflating, right? So those are your cars, your furniture,
food,
appliances, right? Then you have housing rental inflation, which has been quite strong, but is also likely to decelerate quite a bit. I mean, one of the reasons why inflation has historically been a lagging indicator is because shelter, which is a big component of inflation, is a lagging indicator in and of itself, right? And it tends to lag home prices. And home prices have been moderating. And we know that new lease growth has also been moderating quite a bit. So I think it's inevitable that housing rental inflation, and as it's measured in the CPI data, will come down.
That's a key phrase, as it's measured. There have been, both from places like the Cleveland Fed and Zillow Rents, there have been a couple of new ways of looking at rental inflation that make it appear the BLS model is really on a long lag. When you look at Zillow Rents, they appear to be plummeting. And when you look at a paper, I think it was the Cleveland Fed, that tried to look at repeat rents as opposed to the whole world of rents, they're showing that rents not only have stopped going up, but are now rapidly decelerating.
Right, but that's also been well known. I mean, that's been a well-known feature of the inflation statistics, right? So this idea that, oh, this is such a lagging indicator, that's a lot of people just saying that they want the Fed to back off. And they're using that to justify.
I'm talking my book. I'm guilty. Let me ask you this question.
In 08, Bernanke was saying inflation is a lagging indicator, right?
So inflation is a lagging indicator. Okay,
right.
Wow.
So Bernanke made that point back in 2008.
Right around the time he said subprime was contained.
Well, it was
recall.
After that. But he was right about the inflation being a lagging indicator, because he was using that to justify a more aggressive monetary policy easing than the hawks wanted to go, because they were making the point that, look, inflation is still high. Well, inflation is a lagging indicator. So
interesting.
And so it's sort of the same thing that's happening now, kind of in reverse.
But you're suggesting that the Fed is ignoring all of this softening inflation data because, for whatever reason, Jay Powell wants to get to 5.25%.
That, and also I don't think they view inflation the same way as the markets do.
Right.
The markets are very, very good at kind of telling you about what's happening with goods inflation, right? So we know what commodities are doing at any moment.
You could price it, right?
Right. The markets don't have a great way of telling you how much your barber is going to charge you for your haircut.
So services are more problematic.
Or your dry cleaner. And also, it's about the overall inflation process, right? I mean, so the stuff that you're talking about, like, let's say we had this burst of household formation, and that's what drove this spectacular increase in rents during and immediately after the pandemic. And now it's just becoming too onerous on people, and they've all decided, you know what, I'm going to go find a roommate. I've been dating somebody. I'm going to go move in with them. What have you just done for yourself? You've reduced household formation, but what have you done for yourself, assuming you haven't lost your job?
Your rent in half.
Now what do you go out and do with the money?
You spend it on...
What does that do to the prices of the goods and services upon which you spend the money?
It depends on what you're spending it on. Is it these things you wouldn't have purchased anyway, or...
I don't know, but that's the way the Fed's thinking about it. Do you see what I mean? Compensation equals inflation plus productivity. So all you're talking about is relative price shifts. If wage inflation is still running at 4.5%, 5%, it's going to be difficult. Like that, I mean, I hate to say it like this. It just means the disinflation that you're going to see this year is also transitory. That's the thing that the Fed, I think, has to wrestle with, is they haven't really, to me, they haven't told us a good kind of framing around this idea of improving composition of growth, right? Real GDP growth is probably accelerating as inflation is coming off. What does that mean, right? I mean, because ultimately, if real growth is getting better, that means you're putting pressure on physical capacity, physical resources, right? Your real growth is what drives more employment. Real growth is what drives more production. You know, that means capacity utilization goes up, and that is what pushes prices up. So I think that's kind of the thing that they have to wrestle with, which is why I say it's difficult for the markets to get the cuts that they are currently pricing if I'm right about the economy. If real growth is holding up and we're growing above potential, then even if price inflation is moderating, it's still going to be difficult for the Fed to cut in that environment.
So let me push back on all that, and let me give you my narrative as to where the consensus might be right and where the Fed is wrong. And it's two parts, and I'll make it really short. The first part is, hey, we've been in a deflationary environment for the past three decades. Globalization, technology, automation, productivity, all these factors have been deflationary for a long time. The pandemic was a unique one-off, right? And heading into the pandemic, we are 60% services, 40% goods. Suddenly, we invert that. We're 40% services, 60% goods. When everyone's stuck at home, they're not going to hotels, they're not flying, they're not going to movies, they're building, buying, doing all this stuff. Just-in-time supply chain can't deal with it. Prices spike on top of a decade-long shortfall of home construction. And during the pandemic, whoever could afford to buy a second house or a third house did without selling a house. So all this, whatever little supply there was that gets sucked up. And once that normalizes, inflation should return to normal. However, following, that's part A. Part B is the Fed doubles and then some mortgage rates. Everybody who's looking to buy a starter home or a sub $1 million home, a lot of those folks are now priced out of that market and would-be buyers are renters. And paradoxically, rising FOMC rates means higher mortgage rates, which pours people into the rental market, making inflation higher. The Fed, if they want to stop inflation, should stop raising rates and allow those renters to become home buyers. Where is that thesis wrong?
Well, I think on the globalization side, I mean, we probably have a little bit more of a home bias now. I mean, if there's one bipartisan thing that's come about from Trump to Biden, it's this sort of...
having learned the just-in-time supply chains.
Right. I mean, we had the flattening out of the global supply chain, and now the global supply chain is actually narrowing. We want to make it, you know, more resistant to global shocks. And so I think that that's probably inflationary. I mean, we're... final assembly is probably leaking out of the lowest cost destination.
Right. And we'll have a big inventory build, but once that's done, that's transitory also, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it just, again, it goes back to this idea of what's driving inflation over the longer run. And ultimately, to me, it's about labor market dynamics. And, you know, I mean, we had a period of disinflation. It wasn't like, but I mean, inflation was sort of stable in the 2010s. I mean, Bernanke famously said, if inflation's the benchmark, I have the best inflation record of any chairman because it's basically been 2% the entire time I've been. So he actually hit it right on the head. So, you know, so it wasn't like inflation was getting even slower during the financial crisis. And so now,
By the way, I think it's hilarious that a massive financial crisis leading to an inability for inflation to get any traction, and he wants to take credit for it. Right?
But I think about
now do GDP and wages over that same decade.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't until the very end of that decade
that
real wages started to look a bit better. But again, it's one of these interesting things, Barry, where if you look at like consumer confidence, it was it got very good after 2015. Like, so once you started, particularly when gasoline prices started, when we had the windfall from the positive supply shock on energy. But, you know, I do think that, yeah, I mean, there's more, we haven't really invested much in mining CapEx. If you have an incremental pickup in global demand, that could sort of roil energy markets. That's a risk. That's an inflationary risk. I mentioned productivity. Mm-hmm. Productivity hasn't been as strong. You have experienced workers that are now leaving the workforce. That means that the quality of your workforce isn't, it's going to take time to get that back up. So I think there are interesting arguments on both sides of this debate. But, you know, for the short run, I think it's really just about the labor markets. And the Fed keeps saying that they think things are out of balance. And so that means that they're going to have to bring it back into balance.
So the consensus is either no recession or a mild recession, and the Fed stops raising, and by the end of the year they're cutting rates. You're saying you think the consensus should listen to what Jerome Powell is telling them because you think he's going to do exactly what he says he's going to do.
Yeah, I mean, the consensus right now is recession. Mm-hmm. That is the consensus. If you look at...
So soft landing or hard landing?
It's not even about soft landing. It's a recession. I mean, the consensus is overwhelmingly in a way I've never, I mean, I think if you surveyed, it's like 60% recession of the street, if not more. Usually when the consensus is that overwhelming for the recession, you're already in one.
Right.
And we're
That's
not.
That's right.
So
I recall deep into 2008, there was still an argument as to whether or not when we were in recession, when it started 6-8 months earlier.
Yeah.
And right, like, in the middle of that, people were still arguing.
Well, I remember one analyst famously thinking that the Fed was going to be hiking in the back half of 2008.
Good call.
Right. Key distinction, though, of that period was that we were seeing job loss month in and month out over those first.
And we're clearly not seeing
Seeing that now. And I think that is an important sort of, you know, and you can talk about, oh, employment is coincident or it's lagging, or at the end of the day, initial claims are low. That's a leading indicator. And but to me, again, it's not about the data as it's coming in. Tell me why it keeps going. Right. That's what's right. I mean,
so can we get a recession with employment markets this strong, this tight?
You can, but I don't think the Fed is going to give you that right away. I mean, it's going to take a little bit more time to play out. But more importantly, it's about the mechanism. Like, how do you get the recession? Like, what is the mechanism? Like, for example, is there a massive financial shock that gets companies? So the thing that I've been exploring is that one of the ways you get recession, in my view, is through an element of surprise.
Right.
Right? So companies sort of think things are going to be okay, and then something falls out of bed, and that means that they have to cut their hiring plans, adjust their CapEx budgets, right, clear out their inventories. But what if we've been doing that for the last 6 to 9 months already,
right,
and now there's a risk with inflation falling, gas prices have come down, no one's talking about that anymore. Natural gas prices are down, which means you're going to see lower utility bills. Food prices are coming down, which means you'll see lower grocery bills. What does that mean? That is a tailwind for real disposable income.
Mm-hmm.
So that should buoy demand. Now, if companies are all on this side of the fence and they think household demand is going to slow down, and then the opposite happens, what does that mean? That creates a risk where you have this situation where the companies are having to catch up to the end consumer.
You can have an inflation echo and a restart of demand.
Real growth will pick up as a result. And I think that's the risk that I'm more likely to highlight now. And I think that's something the consensus is not really positioned for. And I think that that's becoming the more increasingly the more likely outcome, because we've been talking about a recession for the last three quarters, and it just hasn't happened.
So the question is, is the bad news in stock prices already, or is the good news already in stock prices? How do you contextualize that?
No, I think the bad news is in the price.
It's already in there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Google earnings recession. Everyone's talking about, oh, that's the next thing. Oh, it's, you know, this 2022 move in stocks is all about rates, and the next shoe to drop is the earnings recession. How do you get an earnings recession if nominal growth is running at 5%? Has anyone mentioned about the dollar? Like, the dollar's off 10%. Doesn't that have a mechanical effect on corporate earnings for the multinationals that trade on the S&P 500? And I guess the other thing is, in a weird way, like, interest rates coming down and people betting on the Fed to kind of back off juices the housing market, because you see home building stocks at a 52-week high now.
Right.
Some recession. Like, call me when rates are going down and building stocks are going down, because that would be a big problem. Right. But that's not what's happening today. You know, how many I mean, you've been around long enough to know, like, this sort of cottage industry of nonsense on the street about, oh, the ISM is below 50. The Fed's got to come in and do something. How's that been working out for the industrial stocks call? Industrials have been outperforming. Caterpillar is another stock that's doing really well. So I don't see it. I mean, again, I think the earnings recession call is purely driven by, like, you know, look, the ISM is below 50. I draw a year-over-year chart of earnings, and it looks like it lines up, so that's the earnings recession. But if you peel back the onion a little bit and you think about where's growth coming in, where's inflation, you're still talking about a 5%-ish nominal growth environment. That is not consistent with earnings recession, in my view.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions. alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with earnings. We have people like Elon Musk and Jamie Dimon screaming we're going to have a recession for, what, 6 months now? Are you seeing a recession anywhere in any of the corporate earnings data? You mentioned home builders, you mentioned manufacturers. Where is this recession showing up?
The recession is showing up in the FRB US model.
And that's pretty much it. So I have a friend who says to me, we're not going to get a contemporaneous recession. It's going to be a rolling series of sector by sector recessions. Oh, energy did well. Now energy is depressed. And then this sector is doing well. Manufacturer was depressed last year. Now it's doing well. Can you get a rolling sector by sector recession, or is that just...
Then that wouldn't be a recession.
Okay. So what do we see for earnings in 2023?
Well, I'm not a stock market strategist, but what I will tell you is that when you think of corporate profits, right, I mean, it's largely based on an identity, right? I mean, it's basically revenue, right? Less unit labor and unit non-labor costs. And so when you think about it through that lens, I think revenues will remain steady because nominal growth is holding up.
Mm-hmm.
So even though inflation is moderating, you'll see real economic growth pick up. I think unit labor costs will moderate somewhat as the labor markets kind of normalize. I mean, we won't see as many people quitting, and that should take some of the pressure off. And we see unit non-labor costs coming down because supply chains are easing, commodity prices are easing. And so that should be a reasonably healthy backdrop for corporate profits. The question is what is it, you know, for the markets is if the Fed is not cutting, that means that rates will be higher, and all else equal, higher rates are not good for stocks.
So when we talk about margins last year, they hit all-time highs. Companies seem to have no difficulty passing along input cost increases to consumers, and some companies managed to pass along phantom increases and managed to see their margins widen. What are we thinking about overall margins in the face of 5.25 Fed rates?
Well, you'd expect margins to come down somewhat. I mean, obviously, they're very, very high. But that also means that companies are probably more likely to spend some money, right? So that's sort of the way. And companies spending money, that also helps corporate earnings, right? So it's about why the margins are coming down. A margin decline that's driven by companies spending more on CapEx employment is very different than a margin decline that's driven by
revenue shortfalls
or productivity weakness, right? Because in the former case, there's an opportunity for companies to offset some of the hit to their bottom line with a stronger top line. So that's sort of the way I'm thinking about it.
Huh. So you mentioned earlier sentiment. Generally, consumer sentiment has been not just bad, but like below financial crisis bad. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I'm curious as to your thoughts, given everything else you've said that's been so constructive.
Well, it goes back to a discussion we were having earlier about what, you know, what's easier to form a political coalition around employment,
right?
Or you've never seen this much of a gap between attitudes about the jobs market and overall consumer sentiment ever, right? If you look at the Conference Board data, which is, you know, a widely followed consumer sentiment number, it's very weak. But if you look at the labor differential, which is basically consumer attitudes about jobs, it's rarely been this high. It's basically where it was right before the pandemic, right in the late 90s when the labor markets were very, very strong. So I think that speaks to this inflation dynamic. But what do we know about inflation, Barry? At least in the things that people buy frequently, there's improvement. I mean, gas prices finished last year lower than where they started them.
Which is an amazing statistic
when you think
that we just aren't hearing enough
right.
about.
And then we know that natural gas prices have come down somewhat. That will, with a lag, bleed into household utility bills.
Mm-hmm.
And then grocery bills will probably come down because agricultural commodities have come in somewhat. So all of that should provide some tailwind to to consumer sentiment. And, you know, look, the stock markets are up about, what, 3-4% so far this year?
Mm-hmm.
That should help as well. So, you know, to me, if you think about what drives consumer sentiment, it's wealth, employment, inflation. And
all three of those suggest consumer sentiment should be pretty strong, but it really is below what you would expect given the state
well,
of the
economy. Well, it's because people are keying off the level of prices in some respects, not the rate of change. So I would say that the rate of change in consumer confidence should be getting better over the next several months.
Let's jump to my favorite questions that I ask all of our guests, starting with the question that I really should retire, my pandemic question. Tell us what you've been streaming on Netflix or Amazon or what have you.
So my wife and I always, we try to watch the same shows. Mm-hmm. So we've been watching The Crown.
Uh-huh. So good.
Such a good show.
I think there's one more season coming still.
Yeah. I mean, the last season was great. So we Handmaid's Tale is another one that we watch. She got me into this show called From Scratch.
From Scratch.
Yeah, it's with Zoe Saldana.
Uh-huh. Sounds like a cooking show.
It's a tearjerker. Oh, I mean, okay. But it took me a little bit to get into it, but I did get into it more for her than for myself. But you know, it was well worth it. We need to start White Lotus. We haven't done that yet.
I watched the first season. I haven't gotten enthusiastic about the second season yet, which a lot of people really liked. Have you seen any of Kaleidoscope? It's kind of interesting.
I haven't. What's it about?
So the twist is you can watch it in any order you like, except for the last episode. It's a heist sort of film, and you don't know who is the mole, who's cheating on who, and it's told in a very asynchronous way, where 2 weeks before the heist, 6 years before the heist, a week after the heist, like each episode just plops you down in this random time zone as opposed to telling the story chronologically. So it kind of unfolds in a really and it's a fabulous cast. It's really great.
I gotta look into it.
Yeah, it dropped on Netflix a while ago, and a number of people recommended it. It's fun. There's a couple of moments where you're like, don't do that. Like, mm-hmm. you ever watch, like, don't go in the house.
Right,
what are you
right,
doing?
Right.
It's like that, and you're like, please don't make that mistake. And then certain things like that, there's a funny little thing that happens with a watch where, like, why would you make that mistake? That later on, it's like, oh, maybe not such a mistake. Maybe it was just like all sorts of really interesting things. It's not The Crown, which was just spectacular, but it's interesting. And as I'm moving away from lockdown, I find myself, I don't need 500 episodes of anything.
Yeah.
It's limited to, I think, 8 episodes and done. Which is sort of like the Queen's Gambit. It's like, all right, I could get in and get out of this and not be...
Oh, that's another one that we saw, yeah.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Tell us a little bit about your mentors. You mentioned Rosenberg and Ethan. Who else have been your mentors?
I mean, those are the two big ones, and I think those are two great ones to have.
Sure.
Drew Mattis would be another one.
Oh, sure.
He's, I think, the head of investment strategy at MetLife, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, he and I worked together at Merrill for a period of time, so he would be... someone else that I would lean on quite a bit for advice, and not only economics but just life. I mean, he's got 3 kids just like I do, so it's
twins. Does he have twins?
No, he doesn't, and his kids are a lot older than mine. But so he's someone that I would consider a mentor, not only for my career but for life as well.
Tell us about some of your favorite books and what are you reading right now.
So I have a confession.
Uh-oh.
I don't really read books. I do read a lot of articles on Bloomberg and opinion columns and Wall Street Research, but I'm not a big book reader.
Lee Cooperman says the same thing. He's like, I read all day long. I can't remember the last time I picked up a book.
Yeah. I'm not a big book person.
Definitely a challenge. Our final two questions. What sort of advice would you give to a recent college grad who is interested in a career in either economics, finance, research? What would you advise them?
So my advice would be just get your foot in the door, because that's what I did, right? I mean, when I was in college, I had no idea that there were jobs like this. Oh, there are jobs that where you just talk about macro and the economy all day long and people pay you for that? I mean, It's crazy. You would never think about it. And I think if I'm giving someone advice, I would say start at a large institution, because I get that I'm at a smaller one now. But when you're at a large one, they have so many different departments and so many different asset classes and so many different types of constituents that they serve, right? And you can kind of see every nook and cranny of what goes on in the financial market space and financial services space. And then you can find your passion. And so I would say get your foot in the door of one of these big firms.
Huh. And our final question, what do you know about the world of macro and economic research and market economics today that you wish you knew 20 plus years or so ago when you were first getting started?
Well, I wish I had known back then that, you know, a lot of these indicators that people put their faith in are just really bogus. I had
someone at me today on Twitter about that's not what M3 suggests. I'm like, I thought we stopped reporting.
I mean, there's
M3.
There used to be a time when I thought someone overlaying a chart of manufacturing production in the ISM was like, wow, you really found something really interesting there. Now I realize it's nonsense.
Right.
You know, and so
what else are nonsensical indicators?
The ISM is the one that I harp on the most, because there's a cottage industry of people that just drive their entire asset allocation process off of it.
Really? That's shocking.
And there's nothing those 300 purchasing managers that are surveyed by ISM know about the world that you don't, right? And so I think that that's an indicator I don't like. I think, you know, look, what to me in this business, it's about taking a holistic approach to data, right? It's not about finding the one indicator, right? I mean, oh, look at this weekly leading index. It leads everything else. Well, no, it's just an amalgam of like all these like financial market variables. So why do I need that? You know, I mean, so if it was that simple, there wouldn't be, you know, you don't have to believe like an efficient market theory to know that if it was just one thing, there wouldn't be all these people analyzing the same thing, right? So to me, it's about taking a holistic approach to data, looking at all the indicators, and also remembering that what ultimately leads data is your narrative. You know, people don't realize that. But if your narrative is right, the leading indicators will lag your narrative. Do you see what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And I think that's, to me,
in other words, contextualize the story so you know where it's going
to
go.
Exactly. To me, it's about the process, right? I mean, why should ISM being below 50 now mean I should be negative about things 3 months from now if all these other things I see happening, like China reopening, Europe, whatever? You can apply that throughout all different kinds of cycles. It's not the data itself is not what's important. It's about getting your thought process and your outlook correct. And then if you're right about that, then the data will follow suit.
Huh. Really fascinating. Thank you, Neil, for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with Renaissance Macro Research's Neil Dutta, who runs all of the economic research at the shop. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and check out any of our previous 500 or so such discussions that we've had over the past 9 years. You can find those on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you feed your podcast fix. Check out my daily reads at ritholtz.com. Follow me on Twitter at ritholtz. Follow all of the Bloomberg podcasts on Twitter at podcasts. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps put these conversations together each week. Justin Milner is my audio engineer. Atika Valbrun is my project manager. Sean Russo is my head of research. Paris Wald is my producer. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.